and welcome to the Super High Yield Anesthesia Podcast, the second edition. This is your host, Scott, the anesthesia resident.
Thanks for tuning in to another episode of the Super High Yield Anesthesia Podcast. So today we're going to continue our adventures in pain management. And today we're going to actually talk about non-opioid analgesics. And basically, we're going to talk about NSAIDs, a different type of NSAIDs, COX-2 inhibitors, and lastly, acetaminophen, my favorite drug, especially now that I'm getting old, my joints hurt. So I do use a lot of over-the-counter Tylenol. But enough about myself. That's pretty much an outline of our episode. So let's go ahead and get started. So we're going to just give you like an broad overview of NSAIDs, pretty much know much of this stuff from didactics, but we're just going to go through it, and just for for completeness sake. But before we do that, I'm going to give you some fun facts regarding NSAIDs. And it was developed in the late 19th century, so like late 1800s. Salicylic acid was formulated by Colby and colleagues and what is now the Hayden Chemical Company. Aspirin itself was developed in 1897 and was originally patented by the Bayer Corporation, which is still around. But before it was patented and, you know, in medication form, the aspirin and aspirin-like medications were actually used for quite a while, since ancient times. So, for example, the Ebers papyrus, otherwise known as the dried leaves of myrtle, was used for abdomen and back pain secondary to childbirth, and things like willow bark was used to relieve fever. So yeah, so it's one of those ancient medications that you know, still used today and is tried and true. So yeah, those are fun facts for you. Now we're going back to the not so fun facts and regarding the mechanism of NSAIDs. So basically, if you recall from didactics, like all of that giant cascade, the diagram, if you don't remember or you will like a visual companion to this audio, I would highly recommend you to take a look at the show notes. But basically, it all starts with arachidonic acid. And then from there, it forms three different things. It makes thromboxane, prostaglandins, and prostacyclin. So one of the most important enzymes that forms like prostaglandins from arachidonic acid is going to be the cyclooxygenase enzyme. There's two of them. So there's two isoforms, COX-1 and COX-2. COX-1 is found in most cells, and it mediates the creation of prostaglandins, as we kind of talked about. And then these prostaglandins are generally implicated in gastric protection, lungs, kidneys, and platelet aggregation. And COX-2, on the other hand, is generally inducible by pro-inflammatory stimuli and different cytokines. And this is the one that causes fever, inflammation, and pain. So basically, when we're giving any sort of NSAIDs, so this is the enzyme that we actually really want to block, COX-2. As we kind of discussed in the previous episode, inflammatory cascades basically ultimately leads to increased pain. So when COX-2 is induced by things like macrophages in the inflammatory states, it sensitizes nerve endings. So then it's more susceptible to inducing pain signals. All right, and as we discussed just now, the analgesic effects of NSAIDs are primarily due to inhibition of COX-2. So as you probably already know, there's the different types of COX inhibitors, right? So there's non-selective and there's selective. And this is just, you know, for all you nerds out there, if you really want to know the ratio of COX-1 versus COX-2 inhibition, pay attention to the next few minutes, otherwise tune out for a little bit. So basically, there's a way to determine selective versus non-selective based on the ratio of action causing 50% inhibition of COX-1 and COX-2. So this is the IC50. A ratio of 1 means that it's a non-selective NSAID. ratio of less than 1 means that it's more selective for COX-1, and a ratio of greater than 1 means it's more selective than for COX-2. So again, that's the IC50, and it's the ratio of action determining if it's a non-selective NSAID versus a selective one. I have never seen this on boards, so I haven't seen on ITE or BASIC, so that's just more a fun fact, but you know, something you can talk about during cocktail parties because you're so cool. All right. So next is pharmacokinetics. Regarding the absorption of NSAIDs, it depends on the route you give it, obviously. So first, let's talk about oral ingestion. It's actually surprisingly pretty rapid. The peak plasma concentration is within 2 to 4 hours. And if you take the NSAID with food, it actually delays absorption without affecting peak concentration. So that's why you always hear or see people NSAIDs prescribed with food. Okay, next, IV administration. The advantage of doing this is it avoids direct toxicity to the GI tract. So then you don't have the inhibition of like the gastric protective gastric mucosa, that kind of thing. But the problem is it does not decrease the risk of COX-1 inhibition effects in other organs, so things like renal stuff. So still a big no-no when it comes to renal failure patients. And lastly, the other method is topical. So the local action occurs without any or with minimal systemic effects. So basically it traverses the skin to reach nearby joints and muscles. So that clofenac gel, which I happen to use as well, it's great. So I use that in Bengay, but that's a different story. And it's something that we love to give for chronic pain patients, especially the elderly, mainly because you reduce the risk for systemic absorption. Okay, regarding the distribution of NSAIDs, general characteristics, it's weakly acidic and it's ionized at physiologic pH. So NSAIDs with acidic functional groups, so things like diclofenac or ibuprofen, generally accumulates at sites of inflammation, which is pretty helpful. But NSAIDs without an acidic functional group, so things like acetaminophen or celecoxib, it's more distributed homogeneously throughout the body. NSAIDs in general are highly protein-bound, especially to albumin. And it's important to know for elderly, they have less serum albumin, so they have a higher fraction of free drug. So that's something to keep in mind. And lastly, NSAIDs are generally lipophilic. Okay, regarding elimination, it's first occurs in the liver. So it's hepatic oxidation and conjugation. So basically, it's metabolized by CYP450 enzymes through oxidative biotransformation. After that, after conjugation, it's eventually renally excreted. So that's the general characteristics of NSAIDs. So now we're going to move on to the specific NSAIDs for this episode. So first, we're going to talk about different groups of NSAIDs. So salicylates, propionic acid, and acetic acid derivatives. Okay, so for salicylates, the main one we're going to talk about is aspirin. Aspirin is an ester derivative of salicylic acid. And this one, the very high yield board point is that it competitively and irreversibly inhibits COX-1. So it lasts the entire lifetime of the platelets and it blocks production of TXA2, which inhibits platelet aggregation. And the other important thing is also displaces other NSAIDs. So it increases the free concentrations of any other NSAIDs, leading to potential toxicity. Okay. Another high yield point. This is, very rare, I would say, in terms of like seeing it on, TrueLearn or anything. But if you haven't taken Comlex or Step 3 or whatever, this is something to remember. Basically, any pediatric patient that presents with a viral illness or some sort of fever, do not give aspirin because this could cause Ray syndrome and ultimately bad things like seizures and coma. So again, no aspirin for a viral peds patient because Ray syndrome. Okay. So for aspirin, there's like three therapeutic doses or dosing ranges. So there's low, intermediate, and high. Low is less than 300 milligrams a day, and this is enough to reduce platelet aggregation. So if you think about baby aspirin, 81 milligrams, that's generally used as stroke prophylaxis. Intermediate range dosing, 300 to 2,400 milligrams a day. This is when you get into the antipyretic and analgesic effects. And lastly, the high dosage, 2,400 to 4,000 milligrams per day. And this is where you get the anti-inflammatory stuff. Okay, so and a max dose for aspirin for adults and children greater than 12 is 4 grams a day. Okay, so that's the salicylates. The next group of NSAIDs are propionic acid, and this one contains ibuprofen and naproxen. So ibuprofen is probably the one that you are familiar with the most, especially if you get migraines. But basically, it's rapidly absorbed in the upper GI tract. It has a peak plasma at 1 to 12 hours. It's highly protein-bound, and it's mainly hepatically metabolized, about 90% of it. And it's important to note that there's no active metabolites. And a half-life for ibuprofen is 2 hours. And there's, I guess, two dosing ranges for therapeutic dosing. So the first one is 1,200, so 1,200 to 2,400 milligrams a day. And this is analgesic effects for mild to moderate pain conditions. And higher dosing is like 3,200 milligrams a day. And generally, this is done under clinical guidance. So for ibuprofen, you have to be careful with any patient that's like frail, low intravascular volume, low cardiac output, mainly because if that's the case, they even lower dosage, like 1,600 milligrams a day, could cause renal issues. So be wary about that when you're giving the NSAIDs or like ibuprofen to these patients. Okay, next, naproxen, now an over-the-counter drug. It's fully absorbed after enteral administration. The half-life is 14 hours, though steady state requires more than 48 hours. The peak concentration occurs in about 2 to 4 hours and is also highly protein bound, even more so than ibuprofen at 99% to albumin. Okay, next group of NSAIDs is going to be acetic acid derivatives. So this group includes indomethacin, ketorolac, and diclofenac. So indomethacin, generally speaking, is not used that often anymore. Due to safer alternatives, but it is used to close persistent patent ductus arteriosus, or PDAs, in neonates. But other than that, indomethacin is a non-selective COX inhibitor. This one's prescription only. If given orally, the peak concentration occurs in about 1 to 2 hours. It's also highly protein-bound at 90%. The interesting thing is it has a variable half-life. Side effects include things like GI irritation and sometimes CNS adverse effects. So things like dizziness, vertigo, and lightheadedness. Okay, next is ketorolac, or the trade name is Toradol. It's actually one of my favorite drugs to give in terms of multimodal pain. But basically, ketorolac is a non-selective NSAID. It could be given orally or through IM or IV. If given orally, the peak serum concentration occurs within 0.5 to 1 hour. Other NSAIDs, it is highly protein-bound, has a high half-life of 5 to 6 hours, and is primarily excreted in the urine. So the interesting thing is if you give 30 milligrams of ketorolac IM, it's almost like giving 2 to 4 milligrams of IV morphine. So it's actually a very effective drug. But again, due to the other side effects being a non-selective NSAID, you could run into renal issues, especially in patients that are hypovolemic or the elderly or have underlying renal dysfunction. And generally, you only use it for a few days, like 3 to 5 days. And this is something like a hot take, but some people are in some surgeries, whatever, think that Toradol would have increased postoperative bleeding. So that's why a lot of times, like, your attendings will probably tell you to ask the surgeons, like, is it okay to give Toradol? But I guess important to note is that there's a meta-analysis in 2014, I believe, is under Cochrane review, that it suggests that it does not increase risk of postoperative bleeding versus controls. So the meta-analysis included 27 studies and a total of 2,314 patients. And again, the results show that there was no increased risk for postoperative bleeding. And if you're really interested, you can take a look at my show notes, and I included the link to that study. Okay, and the other interesting thing about Toradol is a possible dosage ceiling. So this study was done in the emergency department in 2016. I forgot where. I think it was in Canada or something. But anyways, it's like a double-blinded randomized control trial. And then basically, patients within the age range of 18 to 65 years old coming in for moderate severe pain, they gave these patients either 10, 15, or 30 milligrams IV Toradol. And basically what they found was that they had the same analgesic effects for all the doses with the ceiling effect at 10 milligrams. So, you know, is it generalizable to like all populations, especially in the post-operative pain? Nah, not really. But, you know, it's something to keep in mind. So like not more, it's not always better, you know. So yeah, those interesting articles are in the show notes. So check out the links if you are interested. Okay, so that's ketorolac. Next is diclofenac. So again, one of my favorite gels because it's good for joint pain, man, and muscle pain. anyways, it's a selective COX-2 inhibitor. It's a wide variation of formulation. So there's intero, parenteral, transdermal, ophthalmic. If given orally, it has a high first pass metabolism. It's only about 50-60% bioavailability. Peak serum is 2 to 3 hours. It's excreted in the urine, so 65% of it, and the rest of it is through bile conjugates. If given topically, it's very minimal systemic absorption, like 3-5%. So it's not nothing, but it's very low. So that's why it's very commonly prescribed to any elderly patients, because it's only its local effects for the NSAIDs versus like a systemic thing that could cause like renal issues. Okay, so that's it for in terms of, you know, the other NSAIDs, the non-selective ones. It's a surprise, not the end of the episode, but it's close. So next one we're going to talk about is COX-2 inhibitors. And the only one that's a selective COX-2 inhibitor in the United States is celecoxib. And this one is 30 times more selective for COX-2 than COX-1. When you give it, it has a peak concentration in about 2 to 4 hours. It's highly protein bound like everything else, hepatically metabolized. And it actually has a gastroprotective effect because remember, it has less COX-1 inhibition, which is responsible for the prostaglandins that, you know, provides the gastric protection. So if you give celecoxib, it has a lower incidence of gastric ulcers. Unfortunately, the problem is not ideal for acute pain due to its longer time for absorption and requirement of a loading dose. And I forgot why I included this into the show notes, but if you want to sound really smart, and then someone asks you, there's a if ibuprofen or naproxen is better for cardiovascular safety, you can be like, oh yeah, according to the precision study, naproxen is not inferior to ibuprofen in terms of cardiovascular safety. So I don't know why I did this, because you obviously can't see me, but I did the thing where you kind of push up the glasses, you know, when you're saying something nerdy. Anyways, so yeah, that's COX-2 inhibitors and celecoxib. Okay, last thing we're going to talk about is acetaminophen, also one of my favorite drugs. And this one inhibits central prostaglandin synthesis, though the exact mechanism of acetaminophen is not clearly elucidated. So if you get pimped by attending, that's like, oh yeah, So what's the mechanism of acetaminophen? You say nobody knows. If they say that there is a mechanism, they're probably wrong, unless, you know, new data or new groundbreaking thing arises. But anyways, acetaminophen has a weak anti-inflammatory effects. It has poor ability to inhibit COX enzymes. It appears to have no effect on platelets or gastric mucosa. So it's safer in terms of no effect on gastric protection, renal issues, but you still have to worry about liver stuff. But anyways, if given orally, has a peak concentration of 0.5 to 1 hour, as a small portion that's protein bound, so only 20 to 50%, it's eliminated via glucuronide and sulfate conjugates, and its half-life is 2 to 3 hours. If given IV though, so things like ofurimev, the main advantage of doing this is it has a faster onset of analgesia, it has a predictable pharmacokinetic and pharmacodynamic behavior, and lastly, it has avoidance of first-pass metabolism through portal circulation, so it could help reduce the potential for hepatic injury. And the last thing to know, that it's a max dose is about 4 grams per day. All right, so that's it in terms of NSAIDs, COX-2 inhibitors, and Tylenol. So hopefully you got something out of that and wasn't too boring. But yeah, so these things that we use all the time, so it's good to know, like, you know, a little bit about it. So yeah, like, I encourage you to take a look at show notes, take a look at those articles regarding the Toradol. And yeah, so the fun fact I have for you today is from crack.com, and it's that the Tyrannosaurus rex existed for over 2 million years. There's estimate to have been 2.5 billion T-Rex who existed over this time. Homo sapiens have been around for 250,000 years. And unfortunately, the only thing that's left T-Rex is about 32 fossils in the entire world. All right. So thanks again for listening. If you enjoy listening to this podcast, or you know, you found it to be helpful, I would really appreciate it if you take the time to rate the podcast on Spotify or whatever you're listening to it. Leave a comment. Let me know how I'm doing. Preferably things that make me feel good about myself. But you know, constructive criticism is also much welcomed. Again, I don't get paid for this. It's more of a labor of love for you guys. So as long as one of you guys are enjoying this and learning things, I am more than happy to do it. Okay, garden credits. The show was written and produced by myself. The main source of information from this episode is Benzen's Essentials of Pain Medicine 2017, the fourth edition, and specifically chapter 51. And intro music is by Brian Teal. All right, guys, thanks again for listening, and I look forward to seeing you in the next episode.